Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where the Honourable Kevin Andrews makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think he was last here as Immigration Minister some years ago. Mr. Andrews was educated at Melbourne and Monash Universities. I became an associate to a Supreme Court judge. Of course, his degree, primary degree, was in law and also arts. Became a barrister, but most importantly, the member for Menzies since 1991. And of course, he held key positions in the Howard government and in the coalition in the opposition years. Mr. Andrews is a bit of a rarity among politicians. He's written his own book. He's written other work as well, but this book, Maybe I Do, Modern Marriage and the Pursuit of Happiness, came out not so long ago, and Janet Grundy gave us a few copies of that, and we've got that here tonight if anyone wants to buy it. But most significantly, of course, Kevin Andrews is the Minister for Social Services within Tony Abbott's cabinet, and his discussion tonight is on the topic, The Faces of Welfare, The Case for Reform. Mr. Andrews, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. It's a great pleasure to be back at the Sydney Institute after a little while since I was here last, back in government and back at the Sydney Institute. So it's a great combination to be here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, a child fidgets aimlessly in a classroom, his mind wandering off to other interests. He can hardly read and just write. He's missed 2 days of school this week. He arrived without lunch and was one of an increasing number for whom the school provided breakfast. This is a face of welfare. A teenager passes most of his day at the local skateboard park. He left school as soon as he could and hasn't had a job for the 2 years since. His life is aimless. He has little prospects and little hope. This is a face of welfare. A young woman sits at the kitchen table. She's suffered episodic depression for a decade. Some days she's okay and able to go out, see her few friends and engage in life. But other days, she just stays at home, alone and isolated. This too is a face of welfare. An older man rests on a park bench. He lost his job 5 years ago and hasn't been able to rejoin the workforce despite many attempts. He's lost faith in the system and is losing it in himself. He wants to contribute but can't. This also is a face of welfare. These are the faces of welfare. People, not statistics, circumstances, not systems. And there are many more of them. Single parents struggling to raise children. Carers looking after ailing partners or ageing parents. And the long-term jobless struggling to maintain motivation to job search. Like most of us, they aspire to a good life. A job, a sense of purpose, vibrant social networks, and the opportunity to make a contribution to their family and loved ones. These are some of the people that our welfare system has let down. It neglects to insist that all children go to school regularly. It allows some young people to leave school without skills to get a job. It places some people on a disability support pension and then forgets about them. It ignores the plight of many older workers who feel left on the scrap heap. Despite past reforms, our welfare system continues to let down many people. That's why we need to change it. Otherwise, these will remain the faces of welfare. Almost a decade ago, I had the opportunity as Employment Minister to make some improvements to our social security arrangements. We introduced job capacity assessments, and we encouraged parents to return to work when their youngest child commenced school, whilst quarantining those who were already on the parenting payment. At that time, welfare groups and the opposition claimed thousands more would live under bridges. Now they claim the measures taken were enough to ensure sustainability. And in government, the Labor Party introduced measures such as those affecting sole parents and applying for disability support pension to address the system's long-term sustainability. But deep down, everybody knows that challenges remain. Indeed, the situation has become more urgent. The population is ageing, the workforce growth contracting, and the costs continue to grow. It is time to revisit the issue. The cornerstone of our approach to welfare reform is the Abbott government's strong commitment to maintaining a strong safety net for those who need help and cannot support themselves. But this comes hand in hand with our steadfast belief that the best form of welfare is a job. The ageing of the population presents a fiscal challenge to Australia. This makes it more important than ever to ensure that welfare spending is both sustainable and directed to those who genuinely need it. The government wants to ensure the welfare system encourages people to participate in work when they are of workforce age and are able to do so, because the best form of welfare is a job. People are better off overall when they're active participants in our workforce. Recent decades have seen substantial economic and social changes in Australian society. The structure of the economy and the labour market has changed, with unskilled work becoming increasingly scarce relative to skilled work, which requires higher levels of education and training. Societal norms have changed in relation to workforce participation of women, working families, participation of people with disability, and the needs of carers. Therefore, it is important that we have the right balance of maximising incentives for workforce participation and self-provision while ensuring the adequacy of the safety net at the same time. It is important for the welfare system to remain socially sustainable and enable people to fully participate in society. It must encourage people to receive welfare payments and are able to work that they're supported to do so. We need also to ensure that the welfare system remains consistent with broader societal expectations to maintain community support and acceptance. The expectations that society has of people in receipt of welfare, the values that society has in supporting those who are disadvantaged, and the way the majority of society operates all have an important role to play in shaping our welfare arrangements. There is a need to remove the unnecessary complexity of the welfare arrangements so the system is well understood and encourages people to participate both socially and economically. That's why we needed a review of the welfare system. And that's why I asked for a review of the system following the 2013 election. As you know, I commissioned Patrick McClure to lead a three-member reference group also comprising Sally Sinclair and Wesley Aird. Yesterday, the group's interim report, a discussion paper, was handed down. The interim report outlines four pillars of reform to ensure our social system, support system is sustainable, effective and coherent, and encourages people to work to their capacity. The four pillars are, firstly, a simpler and sustainable income support system. Secondly, strengthening individual and family capability. Thirdly, engaging with employers. And finally, building community capacity. Each of these pillars is important in its own way. The first pillar aims to address the complexity and inefficiency of our welfare arrangements. There are currently some 20 income support payments and 55 supplements and allowances to recipients with different permutations and combinations. This creates confusion and uncertainty and can lead to inequities and unfairness as people in similar situations receive different levels of financial support and have different participation requirements. We know that many people also find the system hard to access and to understand. There are too many payments and supplements, and there is clearly scope for reform. The interim report proposes a four-payment system, including firstly a tiered working age payment, secondly a disability support pension for people with a permanent impairment, thirdly a child payment structure that brings together family tax benefits, student and other payments, and finally the age pension. The tiered structure would benefit people with disability who have a current or future capability to work and would tailor participation requirements to better reflect different work capabilities. It will also help to address the gap in the payment rates for pensions and allowances. At the moment, there is a $300 a fortnight gap in the rate of payment between the disability support pension and the New Start allowance. This gap creates an enormous incentive for people on unemployment benefits to test their eligibility for the DSP. The government has already taken action to reduce the growth in this gap by moving to a common approach to adjusting of payments from September 2017 onwards. This will help to ensure that the income support system is sustainable into the future. The report also proposes that the DSP only be for people with a permanent impairment and no capacity to work. This would better target the DSP and help ensure that those with some capacity to work get the encouragement and the support they need to participate to the best of their ability. People with a temporary impairment should be supported to prepare for work so that if their impairment reduces or ends, they're in a good position to return to employment. The interim report also proposes a child payment structure which would bring together the family tax benefit, youth allowance, AB study and other payments, which would effectively consolidate payments for dependent children and young adults. The age pension would continue as the primary payment for eligible people of age pension age. As the interim report rightly acknowledges, an individual's personal resilience and family support are important in ensuring employment and social participation. While taxpayers might ask people on income support to look for work and improve their chances of getting a job by either earning or learning, we also need parents to provide a good start to children to help in particular to break intergenerational welfare dependency. This is why strengthening individual and family capability is the second pillar of welfare reform. The interim report looks at broadening mutual obligation to include building life skills, promoting parental responsibility, and improving outcomes for children. In addition, income management helps families to make sure money is available for essentials like food, bills, and rent by quarantining a portion of their social security payments. It also helps to break the cycle of child neglect and protect people from financial abuse by family members, particularly in Indigenous communities. Income management is a useful tool to help people get back on their feet, and the government is committed to using income management to help stabilise the lives of Australia's most vulnerable. I'm also interested in the investment approach to welfare reform, the approach that operates in New Zealand, which uses an actuarial analysis to identify the long-run costs to the social security system and to identify and address cost drivers in the system. The New Zealand approach arises from their experience with their accident compensation scheme, which has been in existence for many years in that country and which they've now modified and adapted to their welfare arrangements. In New Zealand, they can divide the population of people who come to their services into many cohorts, and the groups of people can be identified who need more investment and therefore arrangements made specifically for them. They can tell, for example, from their empirical data over a period of time, that if someone's on welfare at the age of 35, there's a good chance that that person was on welfare at the age of 18 or 19. If we could obtain that sort of data and divide our population into various cohorts, there is the opportunity to make investments in each of these cohorts which are appropriate to the circumstances of the people in each of those respective cohorts. To take a cliched example, the young person of 18 who didn't finish school, who left school as soon as he or she could, has not completed a secondary education, has really got no skills for the workforce, and is therefore finding it difficult to get a job. If we could invest in that person and provide them with the skills that will get them onto a different trajectory, then we can leave that person, as I said, on not the trajectory to welfare, which they might be on and off or on more than off for a long period of their lives, but indeed on a trajectory to skills, to employment, to participation, to being a full contributor in society. We know that if a person is on welfare for a lengthy period of time, they're more likely to stay onto welfare, and they're more likely to return to welfare throughout different stages of their life. Ladies and gentlemen, another aspect of the report is the importance of employers, as you can't move from welfare to work without getting a job. That's why the third pillar is engaging with employers. The Australian government is committed to a strong economy that makes it easier for employers to employ and for potential employees to become employed. The report acknowledges that employers are the key to providing jobs for marginalised and disadvantaged people. However, there is always more that can be done. The fourth pillar involves building community capacity. 2 weeks ago, I addressed the C20 conference on issues facing civil societies in G20 countries and the role of the state. In the audience were many of Australia's largest civil society organisations, as well as international representatives. I cited from Lord Beveridge's report on the Interdepartmental Committee on Social Insurance and Allied Services, which was published in the UK in December 1942. Known as the Beveridge Report, it would become the blueprint for the United Kingdom's post-war social security consensus, and in time adopted in similar countries such as Australia and New Zealand. The post-war ideal was very distant to where social security systems have travelled and arrived. Rather than the confident assertion of government knows best paternalism, the Beveridge Report reflected the virtues of a constrained welfare system. Indeed, the report stated this: the state, in organising security, should not stifle incentive, opportunity, responsibility. In establishing a national minimum, it should leave room and encouragement for each individual to provide more than that minimum for himself and his family, today and herself and her family. In other words, Lord Beveridge made it abundantly clear that any new initiatives by government to address abject poverty were meant not to supersede existing social institutions, but to complement them. For too long, successive Australian governments have allowed our welfare system to grow in complexity and dysfunction, allow it to stifle civil society as well as personal responsibility. We're helping to build community capacity by reducing the burden on civil society, by, for example, easing contracting and administrative arrangements, by providing longer-term agreements, for example, establishing 5-year funding agreements with agencies of civil society, by adopting a report-once-use-often approach and not collecting information for information's sake. We're also abolishing the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission because we approach civil society with trust, not distrust. And we want to encourage giving. That's why we're re-establishing the Prime Minister's Community Business Partnership, which operated under the Howard government. This partnership will bring civil society and business leaders together to advise government on what red tape we need to remove, what constraints we need to dismantle in order to promote and encourage philanthropic activity in our community. Ladies and gentlemen, it would be irresponsible of this government, indeed this Parliament, to leave the current welfare system with its dysfunctionality and complexity unchallenged. But there are no easy fixes here. There are no simple solutions. As elected representatives, it's our duty to secure a national system that is understandable and fair-minded. and to inquire of every applicant of welfare this: what is your capacity to participate? To help answer this question, yesterday I announced a consultation process for welfare reform so that all Australians can make a contribution to the national conversation about reforming our complex welfare arrangements. Over the next 6 weeks, there'll be a series of roundtables and online forums for people to put their views to the welfare consultative group. The review will also accept written submissions, and more information can be found on the Department of Social Services website. Ladies and gentlemen, the Abbott government remains committed to its goal to make our welfare system sustainable and to improve the pathways towards social and economic engagement. Australia finds itself at a demographic and social crossroads now more than ever. Thousands of Australians on benefits or low incomes who have or will become disengaged seek reform. The cameos I mentioned at the beginning of this speech, the neglected child, the listless, directionless youth, the socially isolated woman with psychological injuries, and the long-term jobless mature aged man. These people, they should be the faces of opportunity and support, not the faces of welfare dependency. These Australians expect our leadership to shape a meaningful social security system that supports and does not stifle them. Our task is to replace the faces of welfare with the faces of opportunity, hope and reward that comes from being a full participant in the Australian society. Thank you.
Many thanks, Kevin Andrews. As I said, there's some copies of, Janet Graney's got some copies of Kevin Andrews' book, May I Do, and Anne or I would be happy to accommodate you after. I should say thanks to Ellen's for the use of this fine facility this evening. Until we come to questions and discussion, we've got lots of time. So I just might lead off. As you know, you're the member for Menzies, and as I recall, one of the decisions the Menzies government made when it was elected in December 49 was really to petition Australia somewhere between the cradle to the grave mentality and welfare, and the much harsher United States reality where there was little in way of a safety net. Now, you're now the Minister for Social Security, Social Services. If you turn on your ABC radio many mornings, you'll find some people declaring you that you're tough on the poor and the oppressed. I mean, how do you defend yourself against that kind of allegation that you're really just going at those who can least afford to look after themselves, which has become a criticism in some quarters and among the Green Left, say, in the last couple of months?
Well, firstly, Jerry, for obvious reasons, I don't recall what the Menzies government did in 1949. Menzies talked about, as I recall, in his Forgotten People speeches, not just economic security, but social security and getting that balance right. And that remains the objective of this government as well. Indeed, I think that's been the objective in different economic and social circumstances of all Liberal governments since the Menzies first Liberal government. Look, I think it was Fred Daly who said, in politics you need three things: a sense of humour, a thick skin and a good filing cabinet. Got two of them. I'm not sure about the filing cabinet. It doesn't really worry me about what people say, because these are important issues and we've got to have a national conversation about it. If we don't have a national conversation about it, then the demographic change is going to occur regardless. You know, the number of people and the proportion of people who are aged over 65 in 10 years' time is going to be considerably more than it is today. If you think about it, the last great demographic shift in Australia was the baby boom generation, which coincided with the coming to government of the Liberals after the Second World War. The baby boomers have started to move into retirement, and over the next 15 years will do so in increasing numbers. And in another 15 years' time, they'll be moving into old age, by which I arbitrarily define as 80, but that's obviously changeable. So that has two significant consequences for Australia, and indeed this is happening in many other countries around the world. The first is a larger proportion of older dependents, And so that has consequences for health, for aged care, for a whole range of things in our society, including the age pension. And the second is there's going to be a contraction in the net growth of the workforce in Australia because there's less children coming through and coming through the working age years. In 2004, when I was the employment minister, we had a study done by some academics at Monash University that showed that the net growth in the Australian workforce then was 175,000 people. And then they looked at the demographic projections and came to the conclusion that the net growth in the Australian workforce from 2020 to 2030 and for the whole 10 years was going to be just 125,000 people. In other words, from 175,000 in about 2004 down to an average of 12,000 to 13,000 for each and every year of the 2020s. So this demographic change is occurring. We're not going to stop it. It's like a battleship or it's like an aircraft carrier. It only turns around extremely slowly in a couple of generations. So we need to be preparing for these changes. And this is essentially what this is about. How do we prepare for these changes?
So there's a question down the back, yeah, and then we'll come over here. Yes.
Two of the portraits you drew in the beginning of your speech, or at least two, and possibly more, were young people. You talk about old age and demographics of an aging population, but it seems that there's an awful lot of young people on welfare for all kinds of reasons, and mental health is a big one. Some of which is induced by depression and drugs and all kinds of other things. Are there other factors at play here apart from the fact that we can't afford it? I mean, what are some of the other dysfunctional problems in society that are affecting our growth of social welfare payments?
Just for our podcast people, a question about youth who are on welfare.
Well, if you look at the DSP, for example, people with psychiatric/psychological mental health problems have become the largest proportion of people going onto the DSP. So this has been a change over the last decade or so. Now, some of those people have got a total incapacity to work, but some of them suffer from chronic episodic illness, just as some people have physical disability, are incapable of working at all or more than a few hours, and some have episodic conditions. And the problem with the welfare system is that with a payment like the DSP, it's become a set and forget payment. Once people are on the DSP, they're on it for life, virtually. Now, to be fair to the previous government, because this should be, I think, a bipartisan challenge, they did tighten the impairment tables. And they did put in place some arrangements in relation to having participation plans if you were on the DSP under 35, but they never enforced those participation plans, so we're planning to do that. So there is a changing profile, if you like, of people that are going onto the DSP, and we need to respond to that. And a variety of reasons why that's occurring, and you mentioned some, but there's obviously a whole variety of reasons why this is occurring.
Yes, my son has suffered from schizophrenia since he's been 19. He's now 50. But he's got a very strong work ethic. And for a number of years, quite a few years now, he goes around Sydney, collects the rubbish outside Central Railway on Sundays, around Auckland South on other days, around the harbour, Glebe, all over the place. And for 18, they take 18 large orange bags of rubbish that Sydney Council take every month. But the reason why he can't get employment is the health and safety. He will not wear, he has a damaged foot as a result of a serious suicide attempt, and he won't wear leather shoes. He'll have to wear steel-capped boots, which he won't wear, and that prevents him getting employment from the council, but it would also prevent us establishing him as having a company, I understand. Where, and it just seems to me it's just such a small thing, because like a number of mentally ill people, he only wears Crocs.
Okay. So it's a question about the health and safety laws stopping people who might otherwise get employment getting employment.
And these are things which we need to address because there are people in a variety of circumstances, your son's circumstances, but other circumstances. I visited a commercial lawn mowing service in Logan in the southern suburbs of Brisbane a week or so ago, which employ all disabled people with a variety of disabilities from some physical disabilities to some mental type disabilities. But nonetheless, with the right supports in place, These people were working very productively. In fact, this is probably the most successful commercial lawn mowing business. It does all the parks and the gardens and the council work in large swaths of southern Brisbane. So we've got to look at what the opportunities are there. And I think increasingly we need to encourage businesses, employers, to look to the future, because if there is this contraction which is occurring in the growth of the workforce, there's going to come a point where employers are going to have to look more broadly than they are at the present time, and whether that's older workers for whom there is still some discrimination against, or whether it's people with disabilities, we need to encourage them to be open to such people.
This is very much a problem of government regulation, isn't it? Safety, welfare, state government regulation, local government regulation.
Indeed. I mean, if things were easy, we'd have simple solutions. And when you've got different levels of government, you often have tensions between what they're seeking to do and different objectives. And there's health and safety is an entirely appropriate objective, but sometimes you get tension between that and how you employ people. So we need, as part of this conversation, those sorts of discussions.
My statement is more to what you just said. I heard a lady today talking about her two sons. One's 17, one is 15. They both have disabilities. The 17-year-old desperately wants to work, has tried for the last 12 months. No one will employ him. Her 15-year-old will never be able to work, and she's scared after all she's heard on the radio and the media. And to hear her today made me cry, because all I could think was that 17-year-old who desperately wants to work, and no one will employ him.
And I think it's irresponsible for people to use what should be an important national discussion about how we engage and have more participation to scare people. Because, if you look at it, this is a process. At this stage, all we have is a proposed architecture for how we might have a better welfare system in Australia. To turn that into a way of saying, this is about welfare fraud or something like that, is not helpful in terms of the discussion. So I agree with what you're saying.
I think a related question, I'm working at with these things as well. It is difficult to get work for many people, and that obviously is causing some of the distress that you were referring to. My question is, to what extent the government is prepared to think about recognising volunteer work rather than paid employment? Because there are, as I can attest, many, many organisations looking for volunteers, this and that and the other thing. I'm not necessarily asking you to comment on a national service scheme or things like that, but just the concept of recognising significant voluntary contribution rather than workforce contribution.
Okay.
The question was recognising voluntary contribution as a substitute for work in some cases, yes. The answer is we do that to some extent now. For older job seekers in the job services network, some of those provisions allow them to volunteer rather than be engaged in paid work. So there is some recognition of that at the present time. The Work for the Dole scheme, which we're trying to reinvigorate, in a sense is partly based on a degree of a notion of volunteerism, if you like. So I think that is important. We should recognise that volunteers can be very important. We need them in society generally as part of the answer to this. And more broadly, if you look at the four pillars that Mr. McClure and the other members of the reference group have put forward, it's not just about the sustainability and simplicity of the system. It's all about how do you engage both employers and how do you build community capacity as well. And I think what you're talking about is an example of that.
And following on from that question, I'm keen to get your views on how we can re-energise cooperatives and mutuals to actually help individuals and communities to respond to the problems within their own lives and within their own communities. And it seems to me that one of the examples you've just described in terms of disability employment, there's some great examples where people with disabilities have organised themselves to create meaningful jobs and have actually become very, very successful. But unfortunately, they're a bit under the radar screen in terms of general awareness.
Yes. I don't think that's a very good point. If you go back in Australia's history, prior to the emergence of the welfare state, so prior to the Second World War, mutuals were a very significant component in Australian life. whole lots of mutual societies that were essentially for the welfare, the benefit of their members. And that was a very strong thing. And my point about making reference to what Lord Beveridge said was that if you read back to those times, he envisaged that we would build on that. But what we've seemed to have done, in part at least, is to substitute that for the state. And part of what we're trying to do is to reinvigorate civil society. I think we've done that to some extent slightly differently in Australia than, say, the UK, and we do have many organisations of civil society engaged in delivery of services, so whether it's Mission Australia in terms of job services or the Salvation Army or those to take examples, we probably have done that more than the UK have done, and they're playing catch-up with us at the present time. But my view is that civil society is important because these are organisations that have arisen organically, if you like, from local communities where groups of individuals or groups of individuals have seen a particular need, a particular challenge, a particular problem, and said, how can we address it? And my view is that we need to support that. Government shouldn't try to control it. We shouldn't make these organisations instruments or agents of the state, but we should be trying to facilitate what they're doing locally, and that's an important part of the broader good functioning of our society.
Question here.
Minister, I'm Evelyn Holton from the Board of Mission Australia, and I think I'm just going to ask you, I don't know if it's too early and you're thinking yet, to take it just one step further. And, do you have an idea yet in your head about how you may want to work with people like Mission Australia in the new world?
How might you work with Mission Australia in the new system?
And I'll take Mission Australia as an example of an agency of civil society. I'm really repeating, in a sense, what I've said. I've made quite a number of speeches, both before the last election and since, about the importance of civil society and how we build it. I'm a devotee to this extent of the Dutch statesman Abraham Kuyper's, who spoke about spheres of society and warned that if the state became all powerful, then it, in a sense, reduced the activity of other important spheres of society. And they are including the spheres of civil society. So my view is that, and the example of that is what we're doing, for example, in my department in terms of our contractual arrangements with the organisations that we have those arrangements, such as Mission Australia, that we want them to be more arm's length, if you like, not that we see you doing our work, but that we are seeking to facilitate the work that you do in the community. And starting from that perspective is entirely different to a perspective that says you're just delivering services on behalf of the government. So that's what I'm trying to promote through those arrangements, through having a Centre for Excellence for Civil Society, through getting the Prime Minister's Business Community Partnership going. I mean, the example of that, probably the best example of that from the Howard government years, was the creation of the private ancillary funds, which have basically enabled individuals to become mini philanthropic institutions of their own, and that led to an enormous increase in philanthropic activity, and a lot of that directed locally in local communities. And if we can do some more of that, if we can generate more activity like that, not as a substitute for what government should do, but as an addition, then I think we're building a better society.
Minister, you've talked specifically about making the welfare system more sustainable. I'll ask you about three components of that. The cohorts that you talked about identifying compared to New Zealand will hopefully give you a more targeted programme. If it does that, would you expect a significant number of people to drop off the programme? Secondly, if you make it simpler, as you've talked about, are there areas of administration that you could save, and how would you expect to use that? And thirdly, but particularly engaging the employers, is there a way that you can do something practical over and above what you've talked about to persuade people to try and take more people?
On the third question first, engagement with employers. If you look at the engagement of the job network with employers, there's been quite a reduction in that over the last few years, so we have to reverse that. Part of our approach to that will be to not see training and for training's sake as an outcome. but getting a job as an outcome, and that means real engagement with employers on a local level. So that's something which is being worked through by my colleague Luke Hartsicker as the Employment Services Minister, but that in broad terms is the direction which we would like to go. The second question was about the investment model in New Zealand. Why I'm impressed about that model is it takes a longer term view. It doesn't just see things in terms of the next 2 or 3 years. It says, look at this in a 10, 15, 20 year cycle. And to take my example again, the young person, if you invest in that person, then the chances of that person being in a job in 15 years' time is what you're actually aimed at, rather than accepting that person might be on welfare. And if you take that approach, there's no reason it can't be applied elsewhere. The New Zealanders have applied it to their jail system, to incarceration. You know, if somebody's in jail and they haven't got skills, isn't it better to give them some skills while they're in jail so when they come out, they may actually go and do something useful in the community for themselves and for society and their families, rather than being recidivists who end up back in jail? So you can see an investment model can work there. The New Zealanders are now trying to look at how this might apply in terms of homelessness and housing as well. And theoretically, this could apply to even things like aged care. We know that the greatest expenditure in terms of aged care will be for someone who goes into a residential aged care home, by definition, in the last period of their life. If by making an investment in their lifestyle or ensuring that they get the right medications and take them, or they get some improvements in their home or whatever, you can either delay when they go into residential accommodation, or they may not go into it at all. That's a huge saving, not just to government, to the community overall. So that's why I'm attracted to this idea of an investment model. Now, it requires us having the actuarial data to be able to determine the cohorts so that you can actually determine what the investment is, not quite on a case-by-case basis, but getting closer to an individualised case-by-case basis. The other question I've now forgotten was...
On the cost of administration by going into
Australia. Oh, the cost of administration. If you have simpler systems that people understand, then it should be less costly. Now, that involves investment by government. I mean, one of the changes that we need to make is actually to invest in a whole new information technology system for the Department of Human Services. It's antiquated, and even to make the sort of changes that are being contemplated, we would need a new investment in that. So, yes, you need some investment up front, but you hope by making investment up front, you get some of these medium to long-term savings.
I suppose this is a difficult topic for anyone in government these days, but the best time to get a job if you're a young Australian or an older Australian, or perhaps an Australian with a disability, was during the Howard government, because the industrial relations system was less regulated. Now, I know you can only make submissions to the Fair Work Australia, but within certain parts of Australia, particularly regional towns, rural areas, some of the suburbs, the regulation of the system plus the unfair dismissal laws is a real disincentive to an employer to give a younger person who's not that well qualified, an older person or someone with disabled, it's a real disincentive to give them a job. So in a way, what you're talking about tonight, you standing against you is a highly regulated industrial relations system which has become more regulated over the last 6 or 7 years.
Well, Gerard, as you know, I was the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations for 4 years, and subsequently Australian people changed their minds about who should be in government, so we're not going back to that system, obviously. But by the same token, there has to be a recognition of the changing nature of work in Australia, and we would encourage Fair Work Australia, in making its deliberations, to look at, you know, the reality of the workplace. If you have a contraction in the growth of the workforce, then obviously to attract more groups of people into the workforce, there has to be a degree of flexibility in that workforce. And that's a general principle. I'm not proposing anything by way of that answer, but as a general principle, in order to attract more people, then there'll be people who require a degree of flexibility, and we need to find ways of doing that.
Well, I think that's a good
time, I think, to conclude. We've had quite a lot of questions, so look, it's great to have Kevin Andrews back at the Sydney Institute. The issue of, as we all know, the issue of social services occupies a very large part of the Commonwealth budget, and as the Minister has pointed out, it's likely to be an increasingly high part of the Commonwealth budget, so it's important to have the Minister here talking about these issues as a matter of opening up a general conversation, as he's pointed out, over the next 6 weeks or so, coming off the back of the McClure report. So it was great to have Kevin Andrews along tonight talking about the issue of security and, I think, as he termed it, the faces of welfare, and it was quite a dramatic introduction, looking at some various case studies, many of whom were younger Australians, some of whom were older Australians, some were disabled Australians. So we're very grateful for your presentation tonight. It's an important paper. Good luck with what you're doing, and we'll have you back in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.